Case counts are up and we are opening up. So today on the program, staying safe at work. From American Public Media, this is Market Plans. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday today, I do believe the 22nd of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It has been 100 days, more actually, that New York State has been locked down, one of the earliest and the biggest coronavirus hotspots in this economy. The Empire State moves into phase two today. Outdoor dining is okay. Hair salons and shops and offices can open up in some capacity. New York is one of the last to ease the toughest restrictions after keeping new cases low enough for long enough. But with an upswing in positive tests and hospitalizations in 20 or so states, workers might be wondering what obligation their employers might have to keep them safe. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino gets us going.
We've heard a lot about big outbreaks of COVID-19 at workplaces like meatpacking plants, nursing homes, and e-commerce warehouses. But in many cases, employers aren't actually reporting those themselves.
It is stunning, the lack of obligations on employers to report this data, not only to workers, but also their community.
Debbie Berkowitz with the National Employment Law Project says most states don't require employers to report COVID cases to local health departments, though large workplace clusters are often identified that way. However, OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, does require most companies to keep internal records of COVID cases, but only when they're confirmed and deemed work-related. Gina Fonte is a Boston attorney specializing in workplace safety.
It's a very difficult and onerous task to determine whether or not a COVID-19 positive case was work-related.
And employers have an incentive not to make those connections. Too many could trigger an investigation into unsafe working conditions. She says OSHA requires employers to make a good faith effort to determine how a worker contracted the virus. John Ho is a lawyer in New York who represents employers.
Look, if you're a smaller employer, OSHA recognizes your resources are going to be somewhat limited as opposed to if you are obviously a much larger employer.
He says employers should first ask workers how they think they contracted the virus. If they work mostly with the public or there's been a large cluster of cases in their department, it may be assumed to be work-related if there is no alternative explanation. But with so much of the economy reopened and community transmission widespread, it's hard to know where many infections started. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
President Trump's campaign rally in Tulsa this weekend attracted, well, not as many people as his campaign had been expecting. You probably heard that news. There's a good chance virus fears did help keep turnout down, but people on TikTok and K-pop fans are giving themselves some credit, too, for reserving tickets with no actual plans to show up. Whether that really depressed turnout is up in the air. But one thing it did do was feed the Trump campaign a whole mess of bad data. And that, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, is probably going to cost the campaign some money.
Between the campaign on TikTok,
go reserve tickets now and leave him standing there alone on the stage. What do you say?
And the mobilization of K-pop fans across social media, the Trump campaign now likely has tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands, of people in its database who are not likely Trump voters, potentially corrupting the database the campaign uses to track supporters. Anjana Susarla is a professor at Michigan State's Broad College of Business.
The kind of voter turnout models that have been built need accurate data for two things. One is they need it for voter turnout, and also in persuading the persuadable voters.
Campaigns spend money on text messages and email blasts to reach those persuadable voters. And to avoid wasting money on fake supporters, they have to spend money to weed them out. Lucy Caldwell is a political data strategist who's worked with Republican campaigns, including Trump primary opponent Joe Walsh.
You're asking a data vendor to clean it, try to make a match on something like email and zip code. So then you match it back. You're probably spending between 3 and 15 cents a person.
And the Trump campaign can afford it. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, the campaign has more than $107 million cash on hand, almost double that of the Biden camp. Plus, there's the money and infrastructure of the Republican National Committee.
So we have invested over $300 million over the last several election cycles.
Liz Harrington is a spokesperson for the RNC.
And that all goes directly into keeping those voter files up to date and as most accurate as possible.
Harrington says the vast majority of signups for the Tulsa rally were real. Plus, with the data Republicans already have, she says it should be easy to sort the Trump fans from the K-pop stans. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Monday, more up than down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Dozens of companies buy now, from the investment management firm BlackRock to General Motors and many, many in between, have all admitted they have to increase diversity in their workforce. And yes, this is a refrain we've heard before. And yes, it's just one marker. Here's one of them. There are only five black CEOs running Fortune 500 companies, none of them black women. So who is to say this moment is going to last? Pamela Newkirk teaches journalism at New York University. I spoke to her last year about her book, Diversity Incorporated, about this very topic. Professor Newkirk, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
When we had you on last time, it was for your book, obviously, and we talked about diversity initiatives at companies and how, honestly, they weren't so successful. And companies,
right,
most of them were trying, putting money in, it wasn't working. I wonder if you think this moment might change that.
Well, it's certainly a moment pregnant with so much possibility. Now that so many of these corporations and leaders in the arts and, you know, across all of these segments are now acknowledging that Black Lives Matter, they need to express that in the ways in which they've marginalized and ignored a wide swath of African Americans in just about every field.
What are you going to be looking for to know that this time is different, to coin a phrase? I mean, because it has to be more than just numbers of black people and indigenous people and people of color in a pipeline, right?
Right. And so what we need to look at are kind of transparent metrics, or at least companies and institutions need to look, do audits of their own demographics and look across job categories, across salaries, to kind of detect patterns of inequality, of bias that have metastasized in unequal pay, unequal opportunity, unequal promotions, the ways in which people are even kind of wooed to come to companies. Yeah. Are African Americans even included in the searches? Are they included in the candidate pool? So once institutions begin to interrogate their own practices, you know, diversity or inequality or racial injustice is not an abstraction. It's something that needs to be rooted out within these institutions, where people of color and African Americans in particular have continued to be excluded.
So I was having a conversation with our Washington correspondent, Kimberly Adams, the other day about a Twitter thread that she had done, the point of which was, if institutional racism and systemic economic racism in this country had been treated the way the Me Too movement has been treated, with employees and people on the inside actually holding companies accountable and responsible, things might be different this time.
Exactly. You know, this whole idea of diversity, and what we're really talking about is just racial justice, racial equality, mm-hmm. you know, equality. Mm-hmm. It requires leadership, it requires intention, and it requires accountability. The strategies are there. All you need is the will and the vigilance so that we don't see the kind of backsliding that we often see whenever there's been African-American progress, whether it was after Reconstruction, which was right. followed with, you know, a virulent backlash to the progress African-Americans had made. And, you know, then we saw the epidemic of lynchings and black codes and all of the ways in which African-American progress was stymied. And then we saw a different kind of backlash following the progress that was made after all the civil rights legislation. And so, you know, it's been this dance, right, of, you know, three steps forward, four steps back. And that has been the pattern of African-American advancement in American life. And so hopefully this time it will stick and it will be more systemic than it's been in the past.
Pamela Newkirk is a professor of journalism at New York University. Her book on the topic at hand that we talked about, I guess a year ago, maybe?
Well, it's like
called
8 months
Diversity.
Ago.
8 months ago. There you go. Well, time flies. it's called Diversity, Inc. Ms. Newkirk, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
You might have heard about HBO Max pulling Gone with the Wind from its library a couple of weeks ago with promises that it would be back after it's put in appropriate context. Same basic thing has happened for other films. The Jungle Book is one. Breakfast at Tiffany's is another. These films are classics by one definition, outdated and wrong by another, but they are also key intellectual property that is now going to come with warning labels. Marketplace's Jasmine Garz explains how that might work.
For millions of people, Gone with the Wind is stunning dresses, mustachioed gentlemen, and campy drama.
You go. Where shall I go? What shall I do?
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
But for many Americans, this movie conjures the image of Mammy, a happy and loyal Southern slave played by Hattie McDaniel, who won an Oscar for that role. The film completely glosses over the horrors of slavery. Professor Greg Garrett from Baylor University says when it premiered in Atlanta in 1939, audiences
were basically just confirmed in everything that they believed. There is this very strong mythology about how slavery was not onerous or tortuous.
Gone with the Wind went on to become one of the greatest box office hits of all time. But in light of ongoing protests against racial inequality, HBO pulled the movie from its platform and will only make it available again with a historical explanation. HBO is not alone. British network Sky recently added a label to Breakfast at Tiffany's, long accused of racist portrayals of Asians, warning viewers that it contained outdated attitudes and language. Disney Plus has similar labels on movies like Dumbo and The Jungle Book. Garrett says a label or an explanation
actually is pushing against the white privilege and that filter where white people are like, well, this is just the way things are.
Not everyone agrees. Professor Mia Mask with Vassar University says,
for me, it amounts to window dressing because when I talk to 20-somethings and even millennials, many of them have never seen Gone with the Wind. And so they're really wondering why it's even relevant to Black Lives Matter.
She says networks could make a significant change
by hiring and supporting not only more artists of color, but more professionals of color.
These changes would mean a cultural and economic shift. She says, frankly, everything else is lip service. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Sometimes you get that awful screeching sound on the windscreen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's a bad one. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 153 points today, 0.5%, 26,024. The NASDAQ up 110 points. That's about 1.1%. The S&P 500 rose 20.6%, ended at 31.17. While the market as a whole was up, there were some big losers today, like the cruise ship business. Carnival, which owns 10 different cruise line brands, has canceled all of its sailings through the end of September. The company's stock shed 3.3% today. Similarly, Norwegian Cruise Lines sank by more than 6% today. Airlines weren't much better off. American Airlines announced it's seeking $3.5 billion in funding and financing to ease its liquidity issues. Company stock fell 6.7% today. Other airlines down as well. Delta gave back 0.6%. United down 0.8%. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note, 0.70%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. One hates to add to our collective list of uncertainties and stresses right now, but it's better, don't you think, to be planning for things than not? So with that, college this fall. We don't know when campuses are going to reopen, whether they even will, or what that might look like. But whatever that reality turns out to be, tuition and coming up with the money for same is still a very real thing. Rima Kreis, the host of our podcast, This Is Uncomfortable, has this story of one parent trying to navigate the financial aid system.
It took Nikki Massey more than 10 years to graduate from college, mostly because she struggled to afford it. So when she became a parent, she promised herself things would be different for her two daughters.
I wanted things to be manageable for them because I didn't feel like they were manageable for me when I was in college.
She didn't want them to deal with student debt. But as a single parent, money was always tight.
I'm a one-income household. I need another income. I don't need a husband, is what I used to say.
Nikki was working at a nonprofit and running this lifestyle blog on the side, just for fun. But she thought if she could monetize the blog, it'd be enough to help her girls with school. Luckily, her oldest daughter's tuition, her freshman year, was covered mostly by financial aid and scholarships. Meanwhile, Nikki's hard work on her blog was paying off.
You know, the first year that I was really, really successful at it, I brought in, you know, 46K.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That year, Nikki says her gross income was around $100,000.
And that sounds like a lot on a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I was helping to support my partner who is disabled and my dad who is, you know, almost homeless. Mm-hmm. And then these two kids without a lot of support. So I didn't have that extra money.
But those are all things that her daughter's college didn't take into account. During her daughter's sophomore year, they got an update from the financial aid office. Because financial aid is adjusted based on income, once Nikki earned more from her blog, the school expected her to pay more. Instead of owing $4,000 for the year, they were now on the hook for $14,000.
I was freaking out big time. I don't even know how to approach this.
They're kind of in that gray zone a lot of middle-class families find themselves in. They don't make enough to comfortably cover the cost of college, but they make too much to qualify for the aid they need.
On the one hand, I wanted to feel a lot of pride on what I was doing with my website and things like that. But on the other hand, it was like I made all this extra income and I messed her up.
So to make that tuition payment, Nikki stopped saving for her youngest daughter's college and cut back on expenses. And they just barely made it happen. But her youngest daughter would be starting college the following year, and Nikki had no idea how much that would be. She didn't want to risk a situation where she'd have to ask her daughter to help cover tens of thousands of dollars in tuition. Nikki was at work one day mulling over this problem when it occurred to her.
What if you just ditch the extra income?
It felt like an ironic solution to give up the very thing she thought would help her daughters. But she stopped monetizing the blog, and it worked. The following year, the financial aid office said they were back to owing about $4,000 for the year. But giving up close to $40,000 to make college affordable is a huge sacrifice, Without that money, Nikki had to give up her car and put off stuff like home repairs.
What's keeping me up at night now is like, you know, what the heck do I do when I retire? I have some in my retirement, but not nearly enough.
And now, because of the pandemic, Nikki and her girls are up against some even harder decisions. Nikki's youngest just got accepted into Howard University and really wants to go. But the tuition is steeper than Nikki expected, and the campus may not be open in the fall. If it's not, Nikki hopes her daughter will defer and opt for something more affordable.
So if that's not going to happen, to me, you know, feels like if you're going to go to school online, the community college here in Baltimore is actually tuition free.
Really, Nikki's like a lot of parents who are just trying to do what feels right for their kids, whether that's by sacrificing time or money or both.
And, you know, it's tough. It's tough to get your kid through college. And I thought it was all my fault. But, you know, maybe, just maybe, we're just working against a really difficult system. And, you know, that doesn't make me a bad parent or a bad person. It's just hard.
And she's realizing that sometimes, no matter how much you try or how much you earn, there are things that are beyond your control. I'm Rima Kharis for Marketplace.
You can get all the episodes of Rima's podcast. It's called This Is Uncomfortable. All our other podcasts as well, wherever you choose to download. There is a way to see movies on the big screen, you know, without actually going to the movies. Early on in this pandemic, drive-in theaters started opening, or in some cases, reopening in a lot of places. Those places include Europe now, too. Germany, Lithuania, and the Czech Republic, for instance. Also, a three-screener in Manchester in the UK is set to open. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story.
COVID-19 is breathing new life into an American cultural relic in Britain. In the northern city of Manchester, Maeve Crehan is helping to organise a drive-in movie theatre as an antidote to the isolation of lockdown.
It's more of like a communal experience, just getting out of the house, really keeping the kids entertained and have a bit of a communal film-going experience without the immediate dangers of COVID-19.
The organisers of the Manchester drive-in are offering what they call safe cinema, aimed at families. Safe too, because social distancing will be strictly enforced, with all the cars parked 2 metres away from each other and restroom breaks tightly controlled. The main organiser, ad agency boss Vicky Butterworth, is confident it'll prove popular.
I think it will be a raging success. It ticks all the boxes from a safety point of view in a time where people are still a little bit dubious about what they can and can't do, where they can and can't go, and who they can do it with. Yeah, I think it'll go down a storm.
Actual storms may be a problem. Manchester's one of the rainiest places in the UK, but Vicky doesn't think that'll put off many customers.
I'm not going to lie, the weather is pretty horrid most of the time. But look, northerners are pretty well kind of equipped to deal with the rain. Northerners are tough, they can handle it.
Andy Pates, a southerner who runs open-air cinema shows across the south of England, has his doubts about the drive-in model. Watching a movie from under an umbrella is one thing, he says, but watching it in a car in a downpour is something else.
You've got to start the wipers going. Now, sometimes you get that awful screeching sound on the windscreen.
And unlike in the 1950s, those modern windscreens or windshields are always slanted.
So you're automatically limiting the view because of the slanted window. You've got headrest to contend with.
Also, Pates is not impressed with the Manchester plan to beam the movie soundtrack into the car radios.
Will your car be okay to run on its ignition for 2 hours? Or would we be kind of pulling you out at the end of the night because you've got a flat battery? I'm not trying to be pessimistic.
In Manchester, Vicky Butterworth is confident that such has been the level of frustration with the lockdown that when restrictions are eased further, thousands will flock to her drive-in show. And a little dated slice of Americana will flourish in Britain. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace. We'll be right back.
final note on the way out today, Glassdoor, the job search engine and review site, is out with its list of the top companies at which new college graduates are applying. Amazon is number one, then Microsoft, then Goldman Sachs, then Apple, and TikTok. By location, the preferences are New York City, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Chicago, and Boston. All of the above, of course, presupposing finding a job when the unemployment rate in this economy tips toward 20%. Okay, we're going, but first, your moment of economic context on a Monday from the website GasBuddy. This item, gas usage this past weekend, up almost 21% from a month ago. Still almost 20% down, though, from a year ago. Oh, by the way, in completely related news, U.S. crude oil is back over $40 a barrel. All right, our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.